50 minutes or so.
Philip, thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction. It's true. This is work that I've really just started, or I've been thinking about it for some time. But I was commissioned by my publisher, who hasn't told me that they published a book of mine last week. I've been commissioned by my publisher to write a book on the future of work. And then I thought a lot about the title. Everyone's writing a book on the future of work. Then I thought about, well, maybe we could call it Work in the Future. And then I picked up so that someone's written a book on work in the future. And so none of this seemed to me to be adding value to things that are pouring out every day. Robots are coming. But I thought redundancy of the population was a little bit more interesting. Of course, it's a term, actually, it was a phrase used by Ricardo and early 19th century economists, and because they were also, you know, in a period when Malthus was also writing about the redundancy of the population. So you could be made redundant either because of diminishing marginal productivity of this sort, or because machinery was being introduced. And so there were a number of pressures which suggested to them that population was going to be surplus to requirements. So I thought I'd pursue that a little bit this evening, that thought. I'm very much hoping that you'll help me write the book by giving me lots of ideas. It is a follow-up of a book I wrote with my son Edward, which came out, I think it was three years ago, called How Much Is Enough? And that's the first real engagement with this thought, but I'm not carrying it quite a lot further. The book is going to be divided into three sections. The first is to look at the technical arguments concerning the impact of machinery on employment as they've developed. Ever since, even before the Luddites, but I mean the Luddites are sort of, you know, a sort of starting point for it, and how that argument went through the 19th century and really into the present period, and that would then be followed by a parallel chapter, historical chapter, on what the outcomes of mechanization of production were from about the time of the Luddites through to today. So there were lots of arguments to the effect that mechanization would create a surplus labor supply, and then did that turn out to be the case? And the answer is no, but for reasons we can go into. Then the second section of the book, I thought, would be looking at trying to answer the question, have things changed? Does automation and the advent of digital technology alter the dynamics of the relationship between employment and technology in a way that we haven't experienced in the past? So I want to look at all that. Hi, do you want to, should I wait a minute? No, okay. So are the dynamics of this relationship between human labor and machine labor altered as a result of automation? And here we have endless forecasts. They pour off about the number of jobs that are at risk, the number of jobs that will be lost globally in different countries and so on. It's become a major research field. And in the course of asking the question about are our modern machines exceptional, never seen before because of their cognitive abilities. I could then look into the question of artificial intelligence and things. And then the third section of the book, I thought, well, what is to be done? I mean, where do we go from here? What has work meant to people? Is the loss, the prospective loss of work, in the sense of paid work, going to be, as Keynes thought here, going to be produce a nervous breakdown, and people will lose their sense of identity, their meaning in life, and so on? Or will there be possibilities? Will they be able to take possibilities for expanded leisure, expanded period of non-work in the classical sense? So we look at. I want to look at the way people have thought about work in the past. There's a wonderful book by Keith Thomas. It's not a book, it's a compendium of people's attitude to work historically. And it's very, very thick, and he's got most wonderful, wonderful testimony. So, and then we'll end with policy. So that's roughly the structure of the book. But now I want to come right back to the part I've been thinking about recently. And we can start with this, which is from Keynes's essay, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. There he sort of muses about the possibility of technical development. And so what he says is that technical progress will enable productivity to increase so much that within 100 years we would be able to reduce working hours to just 15 hours a week. So 1930, okay, we're almost there. But we're not really at 15 hours a week. In fact, I want to just show you one thing from a little later on. If you look here, decline in weekly hours from four countries, you'll see really that if you take 1920 or thereabouts, when Keynes was really writing Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, we were in the midst of a very severe decline in hours work. But since about 1950, 60, and especially, it flattened out. And so it's very, although productivity went on growing, and people got went on, you know, there was a big increase in per capita income over that time, the hours of work didn't really fall very much. And so that's a question anyway, but it's one I'll come back to later on. The idea, though, the dominant idea here is that mechanization will bring about technological unemployment, yes, but this will be temporary or transitional, and it on the path to greater output, employment, and prosperity. So what you've got is in the long run, there will be clear benefits from mechanization in terms of productivity growth, increase in standard of living, and indeed no loss of employment. In fact, a gain in employment, given the fact that the population is growing. That's the long run. The rosiest version of all this is that in the long run, part of technological unemployment would be absorbed into new jobs, but part of it would be absorbed by greater leisure. So that was the rosy version, and that has been the dominant way of treating the subject in the literature. At the end of 2017, the end of last year, that is, McKinsey Global Institute published a report called Jobs Lost, Jobs Gained, in which they suggested that 50% of working hours in the global economy, 50%, yes, of working hours in the global economy could theoretically be automated. However, they suggested the proportion wasn't likely to exceed 30%. You know, the theory and application were different. They thought a medium point of 15% net job losses could be expected in the next 10 years, but these would only be temporary. They claimed that although they're in the long run, they'll only be temporary, but What does temporary mean? The transition will include a period of higher unemployment and wage adjustments. And the duration of that will depend on the rate at which displaced workers are re-employed. And, you know, and there's an obvious corollary there. A lower re-employment rate will lead to a higher rate of medium-term unemployment and vice versa. And so how do they propose to deal with this? How do they propose to shorten the transition? The transition, of course, is not something they're very specific about, how long it'll last, by a massive investment in education and training. And that's the standard remedy for these. That's the standard remedy because if you don't do that, then the assumption is that there will be permanent or more permanent labour losses. Not that there'll be, in the end, that there will be, but that it'll take much longer to reabsorb the labour displaced by the machines. And I quote again from McKinsey, even if the particulars of historical experience turn out to differ from conditions today, one lesson seems pertinent. Although economies tend to adjust to technological shocks, the transition period is measured in decades, not years, and the rising prosperity may not be shared by everyone. However, there's always been a strong dissenting view, a rejection of this short-run, long-run sort of way of thinking, which I should say is absolutely central to economics. Equilibrium paradigm, which is central to the discipline, has been protected by that short-run, long-run distinction. Because what it's enabled to happen is that the equilibrium theory has been, one's been able to present it in such a way as to bring it somewhat closer to reality by saying, well, in the short run, yes, there are deviations, but of course in the long run, everything turns out all right. And exactly the same method is used here to try and determine the long-run impact of machinery on employment. But there's been a dissenting view all the way through. And this is that the introduction of machinery will lead to a permanent reduction in human employment, that its effect will be to render part of the human race redundant, surplus to requirements. It's interesting then to inquire into the extent to which that has either happened or not happened. It's not quite so straightforward as it might appear at first sight. The inquiry, of course, is complicated by the ambiguity of the word redundant. But I like the word redundant. It's the word Ricardo used, and I think it's very expressive of all kinds of things, but much more expressive than technological unemployment. But to what extent has sections of the human race been made redundant since these predictions were first advanced? Keynes looked forward to job redundancy, but as a prelude to a much more satisfying life of leisure. So in one sense, the human race will be going to be made redundant, but he thought that would be good because the work would be done by the mechanical slaves, and humans could then, you know, concentrate on much more interesting things. I mean, that's a kind of rosy vision that is the subject of this particular essay. Now, what I want to do is to concentrate on the historical debate. Let's start with the Luddites, because, as you know, they were groups of English weavers who destroyed factory machinery during the time just after the Napoleonic Wars, about 1817, 1818, 1819. They destroyed factory machinery, wide knitting frames and power looms. They were eventually put down by the military. There were more troops sent against the Luddites than were sent to Spain to fight Napoleon. Most of their leaders were either hung or transported. Lord Byron made a very eloquent speech in their defense in the House of Lords, but that didn't stop didn't stop the army taking action. Now, scientific economic theory held the Luddite argument to be economically illiterate as well as socially subversive. For refutation, it relied on Say's law of markets, which held that supply creates its own demand. I mean, that was the basic refutation. Increased use of machinery would increase the productivity of labor and thus the supply of goods. This meant that the demand for goods would increase automatically too. Supply creates its own demand. Displacement of labor would only be temporary. Reabsorption into the same or other industries was inevitable, leading to an increase in total output and employment. In other words, the dominant view has been that technical change is neutral in its effects on labor supply. It doesn't actually produce a net loss of labor. And that has been, on the whole, the view which you can find in Hicks and Harrod and so on. And that was essentially the argument Ricardo deployed in the first edition of his Principles of Political Economy and Taxation. As he explained, I'm sorry, it's rather long quotation, but it's Ricardo is a very careful writer and he likes to explain everything very clearly. If by improved machinery, with the employment of the same quantity of labor, the quantity of stockings could be quadrupled and the demand for stockings were only doubled, some laborers would only be discharged from the stocking trade. But as the capital which employed them was still in being, and as it was the interest of those who had to employ it to produce productively, it appears to me that it would be employed on the production of some other commodity useful to society for which there could not fail to be a demand. You see, there couldn't fail to be a demand. Why couldn't there fail to be a demand? For I was, and am, deeply impressed with the truth of the observation by Adam Smith that the desire for food is limited in every man by the narrow capacity of the human stomach, but the desire of the conveniences and ornaments of building, dress, equipage, and household furniture seems to me to have no limit. And then, as it appeared to me, etc., etc. And so the laboring class would equally participate in the increase in prosperity. Two features of Ricardo's argument have long been part of the repertoire of economics. First, the treatment of supply, labor and capital as completely malleable. In other words, wages are completely flexible, there's a complete mobility of factors, and of course, very rapid skill substitutability. You know, you go from making stockings to making furniture within a day. But look, of course, that's quite plausible in the early 19th century. There wasn't a huge range of these, so you could imagine some pretty rapid substitution of skills, but it's become less plausible as time's gone on. And the second feature is the dependence of Say's law, supply creates its own demand, on the existence of insatiability. In fact, Ricardo anticipates Lionel Robbins's famous definition of economics as a science which studies human behavior as a relationship between limited resources and unlimited wants which have alternative uses. You see, they have no limit, these wants. So insatiability is built into the economist's picture of the way the economic system is going to develop. The detailed argument of Ricardo is this. Machinery makes stockings cheaper to produce and sell. The buyers of stockings now have surplus income to buy something else. Since wants are without limit, they use this surplus income to buy, say, household furniture. The extra demand for household furniture enables the employment of the labor displaced from making stockings. Since all that's happened is the transfer of effective demand from stockings to furniture, money wages of the workers displaced from producing stockings will stay the same. But society's real income will have gone up in the form of the same number of stockings plus additional household furniture. There is no disturbance of the equilibrium, simply an adjustment between different occupations, and running. So running through this adjustment to shock story is the full employment assumption. Full employment is maintained all the way through. There are no lags in the pure story, because of course there's a very, very rapid substitutability. Now, that's Ricardo in the first edition of the Principles. But in the third edition of the Principles, he added a chapter called On Machinery. And that gave a different story. He said he had changed his mind. And this change of mind had been heavily influenced by the intervening work of a now unknown economist called John Barton. And John Barton, in his observations on the circumstances which influence the condition of the labouring classes in society, date 1817, denied that the demand for labour always and necessarily increases proportionately to the increase in gross product, capital plus revenue, i.e. he denied Say's law. The reason he gave was that the extra profits from machines may be invested in fixed and circulating capital in different proportions, depending on which was more profitable. If wage rates rise relative to commodity prices, the masters, will try to use as much machinery as possible, whereas in the opposite case, they will be induced to hire more hands. So basically, Barton displayed a clear understanding of the principles of substitution between labor and capital, and that was way ahead of his time. Now, Ricardo read this, and he said, yeah, there's something in this. So following Barton's lead, he argued that the introduction of machinery might permanently increase unemployment and reduce wages. I won't go through the whole argument, because he gives an arithmetical example. No longer stockings, but something else. Two conclusions, though, from chapter 31, captured the attention of all students of political economy and have been debated ever since. First, I'm quoting Ricardo, that the opinion prevailing in the labouring class that the employment of machinery is frequently detrimental to their interests is not founded on error and prejudice, but is conformable to the correct principles of political economy. Quotation one. Second, that to the extent that this opinion is true, there will, I quote, necessarily be a diminution in the demand for labour, population will become redundant, and the situation of the labouring classes will be that of distress and poverty. It was the notion of population becoming redundant which still strikes fear into those who dread the coming of robots. Ricardo raised this as a possibility. In other words, it was not determined there would be no adverse effects on labour demand. He thought what was more likely was that higher profits would increase saving, leading to more investment, which in turn would lead to more employment. Thus, this very dire picture that he painted could, to some extent, might easily be offset by increased investment, and that meant that a portion of people thrown out of work in the first instance would be subsequently re-employed. So he sort of raises the possibility. He says, yes, you know, I was wrong to exclude it a priori in my first edition, and in the third edition I give it a theoretical presence, but I don't think that's the most likely thing that will occur. But here's another interesting point he made. He said some people have advocated the slowing down of automation in order to sort of protect jobs. But he's against that. And the reason he's against it is, if a capital is not allowed to get the greatest net revenue that the use of machinery will afford here, that is in the United Kingdom, it will be carried abroad, this capital, and this must be a much more serious discouragement to the use of labour than the most extensive employment of machinery in the UK, in Britain. By investing a part of a capital in improved machinery, here, there may be a diminution in the progressive demand for labour, but by exporting it to another country, the demand will be wholly annihilated. In short, mechanisation should be encouraged in order to keep capital at home. A reminder, incidentally, that Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage depends on the immobility of capital. If capital was to be freely exported, the demand for domestic labour might be annihilated, to use Ricardo's word. Now, that is relevant today. And the whole question of the export of capital, technological and the offshoring of employment made possible by the export of capital, that is surely something we should be talking about. And we are talking about it, but again, it runs up against very, very serious obstacles, intellectual obstacles, and perhaps moral obstacles as well. A point to note is that what we've had so far is a typical supply-side story. Demand is just not there. Demand is there, but it's thought to be an automatic consequence of what happens on the supply side of the economy. Effective demand is not mentioned as a constraint anywhere in the 19th century literature. But that became, of course, crucial in the Keynesian revolution later on. Now, Schumpeter, he wrote a massive thing, a book, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, I suppose some of you are, History of Economic Analysis, which is, I mean, unbelievably learned and clever and everything else. Anyway, he has a number of criticisms of Ricardo, and particularly this Ricardo chapter on machinery. First, he says, the postulate of a possible population redundancy covers only part of the sequence of events, says Schumpeter. Ricardo used the method of comparative statics, the position before and the position immediately after the introduction of the machine, but the second of these two states can't be considered to be a position of equilibrium, for we aren't told what happens to the workers who have lost their jobs. And in fact, they cannot remain unemployed, on Ricardo's own argument, unless Ricardo was prepared to violate his own assumption that perfect competition and unlimited flexibility of wages prevailed. So on Ricardo's own basic argument, he can't really, logically, think that the first consequence of the replacement of machinery, labour by machinery, can be the last consequence. He's trapped here. This is Schumpeter's argument. Of course, Ricardo could be released from his trap if you accepted Keynes's argument that you mustn't assume this kind of flexibility. But anyway, that's Schumpeter's first criticism. Schumpeter's second criticism is that Ricardo obviously underrated the effects of the increase in productive power that mechanized capitalism would display, and of the expansion of output the result therefrom, I'm quoting, so that long-run distress and poverty looms much larger in Ricardo's text than it really does in real life. But then he says, look, this isn't due to Ricardo's defective technique. It's due to a lack of imagination. And the lack of imagination is that he never realized an essential fact about capitalist machinery was that it replaces workmen who would never have been born. And that's clever and subtle, because of course the population was growing the whole time. And basically Schumpeter's arguing that the machinery enabled a much larger population to be supported than was the case without the machinery. So the subsequent debate, let's say something about the subsequent debate. Although Ricardo raised the issue of permanent redundancy, he didn't dwell on it. And so the person who really did dwell on it in the 19th century was Karl Marx. Now, Karl Marx said, look, Ricardo said that there will be these other, there'll be compensatory principles. The direct results will be disastrous, but then there'll be an increase in purchasing power, there'll be an increase in saving, that means there'll be an increase in investment, that means there'll be re-employment, and so the indirect effects will completely overshadow the direct effects of the loss of jobs. Marx denied that. He said the story he told had no happy ending for the workers, at least under capitalism. This is his story, very, very crudely. Under the spur of competition, individual companies are compelled to invest as much of their profits as possible in labor saving, that is, in cost-cutting equipment. That's the effect of competition. They're compelled to accumulate capital. But increased mechanization doesn't benefit capitalists as a class. There's a temporary advantage for the first mover, rushing down on declining cost curves and annihilating weaker firms on the way. We know all about that. But competition rapidly eliminates any temporary super profits by diffusing the new technology. So mechanization doesn't solve the problem of maintaining the profit rate. The sequence Marx envisaged was this. Competition forces mechanization. Mechanization depresses the average rate of profit. Restoration of the rate of profit requires an increasingly large reserve army of the unemployed. And it's the reserve army of the unemployed that is Ricardo's surplus or redundant population. But Marx says that's not a fact of nature. It's not a fact of machinery itself. It's the fact that the mechanization is taking place under the spur of capitalist competition. If you abolish that, then you will get a benevolent progress which doesn't depend on creating redundant population. And Schumpeter has a theory of creative destruction, which is akin to Marx's, in rejecting the short-run, long-run distinction. I mean, what basically Schumpeter makes the fundamental point that if technological innovation is continuous, not periodic, technological unemployment is continuous. In other words, the long run is a succession of short runs. You never get into the long run in which you've solved your temporary problem of deviation from equilibrium, because there's no equilibrium. Schumpeter's is a disequilibrium theory. Creative destruction is a disequilibrium process. And so this is how the debate goes. And then you get, of course, Hicks, who introduced Hicks's theory of wages, very important in 1932, which sorted out a lot of this issue of capital labor substitutability. It's his theory of wages. Anyway, so that's the theoretical debate. And I want to carry that through to today in the more extended treatment I want to give this. But now let's turn to historical reflections. What about the history? The Luddites were undoubtedly right about their own trade, hand loom weaving. And what you can see is, in fact, that they were wiped out. About 250,000 of them. They just lost their work, really. I mean, hand loom weavers were destroyed by power looms. And with that, the wages first went down, and then they either starved to death or they were went on to the poor law. And there a bit of data, according to GDH Co, in 1800, wages of handloom weavers were about 19 shillings a week, the same as skilled artisans of that time. In 1830, the artisan was earning 23 shillings a week, while the wages of the handloom weavers had fallen to 6 shillings. Their wages kept falling, and their trade was extinguished. Nassau Senior said they should get out of that branch of production as fast as possible, contemporary economists, and they did. 240,000 handloom jobs disappeared between 1829 and 1850 as power looms surged ahead. But what about the larger picture? I hear there's a really interesting investigation to be made. Population in Europe, minus the Russian Empire, grew from 152 million to 315 million, double, in other words, between 1800 and 1915. Total net emigration from Europe, chiefly to the New World, in the period came to about 40 million. Between 1900 and 1910, the period of maximum outflow, 8.2 million left for the United States alone. So if you average that out over the whole period, about 2.5% of Europe's population left every year for the New World. Now, it's not much, but it's not insignificant. Here we are. This is just European population emigration to America. You can see how it obviously takes off in the second half of the 19th century and reaches its peak just before the First World War. Driven by, of course, I mean, there was a pull and a push. And obviously, transport made it possible, but there was also the imports of grain, which destroyed a lot of European agriculture, unless protection was put on, as it was in Germany. And so, you and of course, you had a lot of relatively unoccupied land. So, in a way, this was a classic labour market, but it was a very peculiar one because all the labour was in one place and all the land was in another place, and it wasn't as we now think of flexible labour market. In fact, the labour market wasn't at all flexible. But this fact that they didn't need to get on their bikes to get other jobs, but they could get on ships, was absolutely crucial. So I think. You really wonder whether structural unemployment wouldn't have been quite a lot higher in Europe had there not been this emigration outlet. What about the other source of redundancy, the fall in hours of work? I've already given a chart on that. I'll repeat it. What was happening, of course, is that workers were substituting leisure for work. But notice the flattening after 1960-70, which needs an explanation. And then, this is a substitution and income effect, which is quite a familiar one. Now, I think I have got to end at this point, but the relevance for today. We know that the speed and power of mechanization has accelerated enormously. This is computing power. And this, for many people, this has produced a tipping point, or it's completely different from previous mechanization. That is the general view. It's not the universal view, but it's a quite general view, which means that the disruption of existing jobs and social relations and economic relations will take place at a much faster rate than it has in the past. The time for adaptation will be much less, which is why people like the McKinsey report advocate what they call martial aid of investment in training, education, just to enable workers and populations to keep up the race with the machines. I mean, that is the argument. But I think history and the historical record of the debate does give us some relevant points, and I just want to end with four of them. The dominant stories about the effect of machinery on labour have been and still are supply-side stories. The supply shock induces a demand response through the mechanism of insatiability. That is the dominant story. But as soon as we understand that deficient demand can exist, the problem of substituting labour for machinery has to be considered in a wider framework. We have to bring in demand and what we do about demand if we're going to sort of get a handle on this problem. Second, we can't assume wage and price flexibility and rapid skill substitutability as Ricardo and his successors did, nor can we indeed look to large emigration outlets for Europeans as occurred in the 19th century, though some bits of Europe perhaps are looking to them. But I mean, in the UK, we can't, and in Western Europe. So we must assume that any prolonged hiccup in demand will reduce the supply of jobs via hysteresis. This possibility should reinstate the importance of Keynesian demand side measures. By hysteresis, just it's a way of making the labor bits of the labor force redundant by destroying their skills and employability. That's what prolonged unemployment tends to do. Third, we should promote good redundancy by arranging replacement incomes to encourage workers to choose reduced hours of work, for example, through a universal basic income. That's just one of the ideas for it. There are many others. With our post-machine standard of living, we should be able to shed some of the Puritan guilt that has for centuries kept our noses to the grindstone. This was the message of Keynes's economic possibilities for our grandchildren. I've always found it very attractive. A lot of people don't, because they say work is what gives meaning to our life, and without work, that is paid work, 9-to-5 work, we'd all be bereft. What would we do? We'd drink ourselves silly, we'd drug ourselves silly, and other terrible things will happen, so we must keep working. And the fourth point is we should slow down the rate of automation. Say we can't do it is rubbish. Of course we can do it. There are many ways one can do it. I mean, some people have suggested taxing the use of robots. I mean, I think that's a rather crude measure, but I mean, there are others you could think of. So and we can take other things. So all these, I think, arise from the historical debate. They're reflections on the historical debate. I'll stop at that point.
Thank you very much, Robert, for your excellent...